Okay. Our fourth case today is 2018-1307, State of Ohio, ex rel. Elliot Feltner versus Cuyahoga County Board of Revision et al. We have Judge Robert Hendrickson from the 12th District sitting in for Justice Stewart. Welcome, Judge.
Thank you.
Here you are. Okay, for the relator, Mr. Engel.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, Justices. May it please the Court. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. In 2014, Elliot Feltner inherited a piece of commercial property from his wife. Now, it had over $40,000 of delinquent taxes on it, but it was worth over $140,000. His plan was to sell the property, pay the taxes, and then use the rest of the money to fund his retirement. Then the Cuyahoga County Treasurer filed a Board of Revision tax foreclosure. When the dust settled, the property had been transferred to the Cuyahoga County Land Bank. The county had itself received no money for the taxes. Feltner received no money for his equity, but the land bank profited $15,000 by selling the property to an auto repair business. Now, the issue today before the court.
Did he still have the tax to pay?
No, he did not.
That was wiped clean.
It was wiped clean pursuant to the statute. No tax dollars were collected, all tax liability extinguished. But the question before the court today is whether the Board of Revision had the constitutional authority to terminate Elliot Feltner's property rights. Now, this case presents two distinct aspects of the separation of powers doctrine. The first relates to the legislative delegation of judicial power to an administrative board.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. So I guess your argument is that this tax lien, what happened in the Board of Revision, that was a judicial power, and therefore an executive branch agency couldn't execute that. Is that fair?
Correct, because the nature of the proceeding and the nature of the relief.
Well, but so
granted.
So I, you know, to me, if I'm interested in what the judicial power is, I look back at in 1851 when our Constitution was adopted and see what judicial power meant at the time.
Correct.
And how were tax liens treated at the time? How when the government owned when someone owed a tax to the government, was there a right to a foreclosure proceeding?
Your Honor, I haven't the slightest clue. You got me on that one. I apologize.
What if I told you that in Ohio there wasn't, that the treasurer could go out and sell someone's property, there was no foreclosure, a court wasn't involved? Would that affect your argument?
Wouldn't necessarily surprise me, but that's not the facts that we're dealing with today and the structure.
But we are dealing with what judicial power means, right?
Correct.
So, and I assume that it's relevant what it meant at the time the Constitution was adopted, right?
That is the standard. You're correct, Your Honor.
So why wouldn't it matter?
Well, one, obviously I can't fully respond to your point, not knowing exactly what powers the treasurer had at that time. The difference is that it doesn't sound as though the county treasurer was exercising judicial powers in doing that. Because it did not hail the property owner before the court or before a board. It did not summon other interest holders before it. It did not then terminate those other interest holders' property rights. What you describe is something more akin to almost a repo man, if you will. I mean, it was actual a physical seizure of assets to satisfy a tax lien, if I understood you.
Well, I think that's the point, right? There didn't need to be a judge involved to take someone's assets to satisfy a tax lien.
Yes.
And sell them to someone else. So.
But there was foreclosure practice at that time in 1851. And foreclosures were handled by, were always considered actions in equity, handled by courts of chancery. And that's what makes foreclosure somewhat special.
But were those but when the government was owed money, did that procedure apply?
That I do not know, Your Honor. One of the things that is troubling about the statutes that we're talking about here today, is the reason the General Assembly enacted the statutes. And we find the answer to that in the briefing of the respondent and the amici curiae as to why they thought the statutes were needed and required. On page 2 of the Treasurer's brief, the Treasurer's Association brief, they state that the Board of Revision foreclosures are exactly like judicial foreclosures, except they're more expeditiously adjudicated. And that is a theme that runs throughout all of my colleagues' briefing. It's the problem was the courts weren't foreclosing properties fast enough. It wasn't efficient, it wasn't reliable, it wasn't uniform, and it wasn't fast enough. So in other words, the reason the General Assembly enacted these statutes was not to give an administrative agency additional powers with which to perform its administrative function. Rather, the General Assembly just said it didn't like the way the courts were doing their jobs. To me, that seems like a direct encroachment on the power of the judiciary. Now, one of the things that is striking about these foreclosures are the powers that are given to the Board of Revision. Now, let's keep in mind the Board of Revision traditionally is an administrative board that hears objections to auditor valuations of real estate. And historically, you file a complaint, you go in, you have a hearing, and the Board of Revision may change the value of your real estate or it may not. These are entirely new powers that are being provided to the Board of Revision. And they're powers that I am unaware have been granted to other administrative boards or agencies.
Council, doesn't, under the statute, it allows the property owner at any time to have it removed into the court system?
That's true, Your Honor, but you know, the fact that Feltner could have dodged the bullet doesn't necessarily mean that the shot was legally fired in the first instance. The problem with relying on, gee, you could have avoided what you're complaining about, is that we still have a proceeding that was commenced and prosecuted, at least initially, under a statute that, at least from my perspective, is unconstitutional based upon separation of powers, and an action based that is unconstitutional is void. So just being able to dodge the bullet, so to speak, doesn't really get to the heart of the matter.
Counsel, don't we have case law that says that as long as there is judicial de novo review of a board decision, that it passes muster?
That's the general rule.
It was Jakubowicz case?
Jakubowicz, yes.
Okay. Why does that not apply here?
Well, for one, and we could go back to Stanton v. Tax Commissioner and the FASIG decision, which is referenced in the briefing. In each one of these cases, and in every case that I saw that related to the issue of quasi-judicial authority, the power was always granted to the agency to assist it in the fulfillment of its administrative functions. So this is very different in that the power wasn't given to the Board of Revision to help it do its normal job. It was to take the power away from the courts on certain types of claims. But the other problem we have, Your Honor.
Well, to initially do that, but there is court involvement at
correct.
The insistence of your client or any other client similarly situated, which then would halt the Board of Revision.
That's correct.
Your client just didn't get notice to employ that.
Correct.
That's a very different question than what we have before us, and whether or not he should be able to, you know, do something about his lack of notice is not, you know, you're asking us, to throw the baby out with the bathwater, maybe.
Well, Your Honor, keep in mind in Mr. Feltner's case has some specific facts that I think will help the court, and they relate to what notice he received of the judgment of the Board of Revision and whether he had a meaningful right to appeal. In this case, Mr. Feltner actually appeared at a March 2017 hearing, and yet when this final hearing was held in June, when the Board of Revision issued its decisions, he was provided with no notice of what those decisions were. So he was never informed of a couple important things. One is the time at which his right to appeal ran and when it subsequently ended then, which is only 14 days under the statute. But also keep in mind that the under the alternative right of redemption statute in that's contained in this law, you have 28 days, if the property is going to be directly transferred, you have 28 days from the entry of judgment. Now, if the property would be sold, as it normally is in a normal foreclosure, you have until the date of confirmation of the sale. So you have two different end dates on when your right of redemption ends. The problem is, without receiving copies of the order, he doesn't know which of those end dates apply, and he's got no way of knowing how to exercise his right to redeem. Now, there are a couple things about the powers granted to the Board of Revision that I believe are unusual. The first is, this is not the traditional type of proceeding in which the state and an individual are engaged in some controversy about maybe whether the individual's entitled to a governmental benefit, or whether the individual has breached some aspect of a license granted by the state. There are more people than that involved. The county must, when it brings this suit, name all the interest holders. That would include even the federal government, if they have a tax lien on the property. So you have not just the two main parties duking it out, so to speak. You've got lots of other people who are being hailed before the board to present their rights. Secondly, you can have private individuals bringing cases in the Board of Revision. I know of no instance where an administrative board has jurisdiction to hear conflicts between private individuals, and yet that is the statutory scheme we have here. The other thing is, this jurisdiction granted to the Board of Revision is actually concurrent with the Common Pleas Court. These cases can be transferred back and forth. You know, I think there's no doubt that if we walk into a courtroom and have a tax foreclosure, that the proceedings are judicial in nature. But I'm afraid my colleagues would argue that if you walk down to the hall to the Board of Revision and do the exact same thing, all you're dealing with is an administrative proceeding. To me, that doesn't make sense. I believe there's something inherent about certain aspects of the exercise of judicial power that cannot be delegated to a mere administrative agency. And I believe one of those aspects relates to fundamental rights. Article 1, Section 19 of our Constitution states that private property shall forever be held inviolate. It's a little disturbing that the General Assembly has decided that those property rights are not so important in these cases and could be decided as if they were just a ministerial issue. There's another aspect to this matter that's disturbing as well. It has to do with the super concentration of governmental power in a single branch of government. And in this case, that's the Cuyahoga County Executive. Not all counties have this type of structure, so it's somewhat unique, and it's governed by the Cuyahoga County Charter. But if we look at the players in the typical Board of Revision tax foreclosure case, you have the county treasurer, who is the plaintiff. You have the county treasurer, who's a member of the Board of Revision. You have the county treasurer, who by statute sits on the board of the county land bank that is then deeded the property. By any measure, that's a rather incestuous mix. It's a little bit more problematic here in the Cuyahoga County context, because the county executive has such control over aspects of county government. The county treasurer serves at the pleasure of the county executive. The county executive essentially controls two votes to put people on the Board of Revision and appoint people to hearing officers. And then the county executive essentially controls two votes on the land bank that's benefiting from these proceedings. I believe that to be a concentration of power that is simply not acceptable under separation of powers jurisprudence.
Counselor, you've used your time.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Stephen Funk of the law firm of Retzel and Anders on behalf of respondents. I'm going to split my time with my colleague, Adam Judy, who's with the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office. I will be addressing count one, which is a separation of powers claim. Mr. Judy will be addressing count three. We're going to split our time with me taking 10 minutes and he's going to speak for 5 minutes. I appreciate the court's patience with that. Now, with respect to count one, what appellants are essentially ignoring is the applicable case law that governs the separation of powers doctrine. This court did a fairly extensive analysis of the separation of powers doctrine in the State versus Bodke case decided in 2010. And in that decision, it talked about that doctrine is designed to address two dangers. One is where the judicial branch is being asked to perform functions that are supposed to be performed by executive branch of government. And the second is involving a situation where a law impermissibly threatens the institutional integrity of the judicial branch of government. And in that situation, the court recognized that that would happen if an executive branch were to review a court decision or to reopen a final judgment. Here we don't have any interference.
Sorry, counsel, don't we have a threshold question, though? And that's to determine whether there was jurisdiction and what that jurisdiction looked like. Can you address that first?
Yeah, well, I mean, the question that they're raising in count one is they're raising that the statute is facially unconstitutional. And that's the basis by which they're challenging jurisdiction. So on that separation of powers doctrine law, we submit that there is no basis to suggest that the statute is violation of the separation of powers doctrine. And the primary reason for that is because this is a tax, the statutes only apply to tax foreclosure actions for abandoned land. Tax foreclosure actions, the Supreme Court has held plenary power over, General Assembly has plenary power over tax matters. And so therefore, it's well established that tax foreclosure and tax matters are something that's created entirely by statute. So the powers and duties that either the courts exercise or the Board of Revision exercise are created by statute, they're determined by statute, and they're controlled by statute. And so that would be true whether it was in a court or in a Board of Revision.
Well, so we're here on a writ. We're here under original action. So if our first question is the lack of jurisdiction patent and unambiguous?
Right.
If we agree with you and say there is statutory jurisdiction, why would we get to the substantive separation of powers issue at all? Wouldn't we just dismiss on that basis?
Yes, Your Honor, you could move to dismiss on that basis, and we did move to dismiss on that basis. The court dismissed all the claims except for two grounds. One was the separation of powers and the due process claim that Mr. Judy's going to speak to. But I do submit that the Board of Revision clearly had jurisdiction, and that jurisdiction derives from statute. And that would be true even if it was in the court. There would only be jurisdiction if the statute provided that they would have jurisdiction. Because it is a tax foreclosure matter, there is no inherent or equitable powers at play here.
So back to my question I asked your opposing counsel. In 1851, what was the understanding of the judicial power that included tax foreclosure matters?
My understanding of the law is that with respect to tax foreclosure, it's always been something created by statute and controlled by statute and determined by statute. There never was any equitable authority over tax foreclosure. So in other words, the rights and powers and remedies are all created by the General Assembly, and the court would be enforcing those remedies just in the same manner that a Board of Revision would be. The main difference, really the question, the separation of powers question that's presented, is can the General Assembly delegate certain tasks to an administrative body subject to judicial review, which is what we have here. And this court has held that criminal matters cannot be delegated, but when it comes to the civil enforcement of state statutes, and particularly in this case, tax statutes, that can be delegated to an administrative body, and in fact, that happens all the time throughout the Ohio Revised Code. There is always provisions for judicial review, and in this case, we have multiple provisions for judicial review. There's the opportunity to transfer the case at the outset to the Court of Common Pleas, and there is de novo review at the end.
Could the General Assembly say that all tort cases have to first be heard by administrative review as long as they gave a right of de novo appeal? Would that be okay?
Well, that's a different question, but I know that this court dealt with that in the Stetter case. They talked about there being intentional torts being reviewed by the administrative body, and in that situation, the court found that there would be no separation of powers issue. You know, in this case, we're not dealing with common law questions. This is something that's inherently controlled by statute. So with respect to this particular matter, I think there's no question that they can delegate that to the administrative body. And again, it's important to remember, these are only for abandoned properties. And in general, the way this works is it's usually not contested. If the party wants
counsel,
to
contest. Counsel, was this, in fact, an abandoned property that fits within the statute?
Yeah, I believe that's undisputed, Your Honor.
It's undisputed?
Yeah. There's no contention that it was not in the agreed statement of facts. And also, Mr. Feldner filed an affidavit. In that affidavit, he did not dispute that. So there's no question that it was tax delinquent and that it was abandoned. So there was jurisdiction. That's why they're resting on these constitutional arguments. But the key thing here is that generally these are situations where they're not being contested. And that's really why the General Assembly came up with this expedited foreclosure process, because they wanted to be able to move those kinds of cases along. If a property owner wants to contest it, they do not lose any of their rights. They have the ability to transfer the case to the court, and they have the ability to do de novo review. They also have the ability to redeem the taxes at any point in the process. So there are lots of protections in the statute to protect rights. And so that's why this case is very similar to the Walker case, which was decided in 2014, where in that case you had an administrative enforcement scheme that complemented the judicial branch of government, because there was judicial review, and it didn't deprive the judicial branch of anything. It simply complemented the work of judicial branch, and that's what this court held in the Walker case. And that's where I think a key thing here is, I think they feel that because they use the word foreclosure, that somehow makes it different. And the reality is that this is a tax foreclosure. The tax foreclosure is entirely statutory. There is no equity involved. In fact, this court has said when it comes to tax matters, equity does not even apply. So again, it comes back, we ask the court simply to follow the case law. This is a situation where the court has written fairly extensively about separation of powers doctrine, both in the Bodke case and the Central Ohio Transit Authority case, and neither one of the dangers are at issue in this case.
This Counsel, is this scheme that's in place in Cuyahoga County, is it unique to Cuyahoga County?
No, Your Honor, it's not. It's actually been adopted. It's in our affidavits that are submitted as part of the agreed statement. It's been adopted in 14 different counties.
Okay.
And in
Do
fact,
they have it, the type, not all of those counties have the structure that Cuyahoga County has, which is the executive and the county council, you know, like Summit County has. Does that make a difference? Because it does seem to be a little incestuous with the decision makers, you know, all being the same people, just wearing different hats at different times.
Mr. Judy will address to that, but no, it does not make a difference, Your Honor. And that, the reason why I say that is because the Alliance Towers case was out of Stark County, and that dealt with a different board composition. The Jacobovich case was out of Cuyahoga County.
Right.
And so in both situations, the court found, in that situation, the court found that it's not a due process violation because, one, you have no evidence of actual bias, but two, you also have the opportunity for de novo review by the Board of Tax Appeals. In this case, you actually have the opportunity to go to a court if you want to contest. You also have the opportunity for de novo review, which is broader than the review you would get under 2506 appeal. So you have even more review than you would have in the Jacobovich and the Alliance Towers cases. So we submit that this is really the holding on the separation of powers claim really can turn on what this court held in the Central Ohio Transit case. In that case, you had CERB being delegated the responsibility to determine whether a strike presented a clear and present danger. And the court said that's not a separation of powers problem because the statute does not authorize an administrative board to review a prior determination, nor does it empower the administrative board to control or impede the court's jurisdiction. The same is true here. We have a situation where the courts retain judicial primacy. If anybody wants to contest it, they can transfer it. They can seek de novo judicial review. And so, therefore, it does not raise any separation of powers issue at all. The board does have jurisdiction granted to them by statute. They exercise only the powers granted to them by statute. And so, therefore, the writ of prohibition should be denied. Before I turn it over to my colleague, I just want to address one point that was raised by the appellants. The argument about not receiving notice of the board's decision is an argument that was never raised in their merit brief. We submit that it has been waived. It's not part of the record. Mr. Feltner filed an affidavit. He does not make any mention about not receiving anything. There's a presumption of regularity that comes with proceedings. There's no factual basis based upon the record and the evidence in the record to establish that he would not have received notice of that or that the clerk did not send that out. But in any event, we submit that that has been waived because it was never raised in the merit brief and it was only raised for the first time in the reply brief. And we also submit that it wouldn't go to the issue of jurisdiction, which is a writ of prohibition action. Jurisdiction was created as soon as the service of the summons occurred, as well as compliance with the statutory requirements. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Judy for the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court, Adam Judy, Assistant Cuyahoga County Prosecutor, on behalf of the Cuyahoga County respondents. I will be addressing and focusing my time on the alleged due process arguments raised by Relator in his complaint in count three. Relators have failed to provide any evidence or law in support of their argument in alleging a conflict of interest in either the composition or in the proceedings before the Board of Revision. In addressing this claim, this court should look to its prior decisions in Alliance Towers and more recently the majority opinion in Jakubowicz, finding that the de novo review does allow for due process to be served. In that case, it was found that it would have to show bias in order for there to be any relief available to the complaining party. The relator has provided no evidence of bias in the Board of Revision or that there has been any absence of good faith or failure to exercise good judgment. The most important part of that case, though, was the opportunity for de novo review. There are other avenues for access to judicial process if any party who feels they aren't getting a fair shake in the Board of Revision, the first being the automatic right to transfer the case within 14 days of the complaint being filed, but also any time throughout the proceedings, the party that's aggrieved can ask that the board transfer the matter. It could be for the property becoming non-abandoned, or if the property is dealing with a complex set of circumstances that the board doesn't feel they can handle. And finally, the statute says they can transfer it for any other reason. And Mr. Feltner did appear at the hearing, so he asked for more time, and had he felt that he needed, due to him not getting the good faith or the exercise of good judgment of the board, ask at that time for a transfer as opposed to the matter proceeding. The due process requires the reasonable notice and opportunity to be heard, and we've had that here in this case. It's not uncommon, and it doesn't violate due process for a member of the executive branch to delegate their authority to a hearing officer or a board to decide the merits of an administrative claim. And I think we have that here. We have people presenting to the Board of Revision, which hires hearing panels. These three-member independent hearing panels are parties that are hired, but they are merit-based hires, and they're independent of the actual statutory members of the Board of Revision. The prosecuting attorney brings the case in the name of the treasurer as required by the revised code. The prosecuting attorney and the treasurer do not actually appear as members of the hearing panel, so there is no conflict or perceived conflict between the parties. The hearing panels, the Board of Revision members, the statutory board members cannot be members of that hearing panel, nor can the charter in Cuyahoga County prohibits the ex parte communications regarding the merits. So there's pure insulation between that. There's no conflict of judgment. Finally, to address the relator's claims that the county executive and the county treasurer being members of the board of the Cuyahoga County Land Reutilization Corporation creating some form of incestuous relationship. This is a model designed and it's covered by statute. The members of the nine-member Board of Directors. The two of them are the county executive and the treasurer in Cuyahoga County. But the composition is established by statute, and as a quasi-governmental body, the members are selected to represent the interests of the general public and not their own personal individual interests. So I think most importantly, to indicate that there is no compensation that goes to any of these Board of Directors members, unlike a private Board of Directors. And their purpose is solely to carry out the facilitating the reclamation, rehabilitation, and reutilization of vacant, abandoned, and tax foreclosed or other real property. Respondents respectfully request this court reject relator's unsubstantiated arguments and follow its prior precedents in Jakubowicz and deny the writs of prohibition on counts 1 and 3 of relator's or relator's complaint and dismiss this action. Thank you.
Thank you. Council, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you. I just wanted to quickly address the Jakubowicz at Alliance Towers cases, Your Honor. Those cases were traditional Board of Revision cases. And interestingly, in Jakubowicz, this court stated that the members of the Board of Revision are county officers and they're doing the county business. So the court inherently, or the court recognized the conflict that they have. My biggest concern with all of this is that the proceedings here terminated property interests. This is a fundamental right under Ohio's Constitution. It is not a mere ministerial function.
Counsel, but there was no dispute that this property was abandoned, correct? Is it in the record?
There's
no dispute.
On its face, it probably satisfies.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.